My name is Nancy McCall, and I'm the archivist for the Johns Hopkins Medical Institutions, which includes Johns Hopkins Hospital and the three academic divisions, the Schools of Nursing, Medicine, and Public Health. And well, for a number of years, we've been contemplating about what to do with research data. We no longer have too much time to contemplate, but we have to act because it's starting to enter the doors of our repository. There are essentially two types of research data that we now have and are dealing with. And number one, all of the clinical type of data, patient studies, clinical trial data. And then we are now finding some experimental data, especially in molecular biology. And as we try to appraise this material, we've had to reach out to many people to help guide us. And given the issues we've had to deal with in trying to appraise these and also trying to decide whether this is material for an archives, I thought it would be very helpful to have a session and bring in more diverse opinions and experience. And as I say, you know, this may be in part of our consideration of, you know, whether this is appropriate for an archives. We've had to stop thinking about that because we are an institutional archives, and our institution does expect us to help with this. So it's a new challenge for us. We are very pleased to have such a good group here, and I don't want to take up too much time with the introductory matter because I want to give them as much time to speak as possible. But I thought it might help if I could provide some context for the issues that we will be discussing. One of the issues we've been dealing with is criteria for selection. And much to our interest and sometimes surprise, we're finding the age of compliance is really helping archivists, because now the institution at, you know, very high executive levels is very concerned about meeting legal and regulatory compliance. And then many grants now require that data be saved, maintained in a viable format so that it can be used, reused again. So there are now grant requirements. And then for a number of years, there have been publication requirements. All of the major medical journals, from JAMA to the New England Journal, have teams of statisticians who review data, and articles submitted for review must also include data. And so there's a much more conscious effort throughout, I think, academic health centers about preserving data in and then the other things that we are considering, especially with clinical trial data, we're facing the fact that really the first generation of clinical trialists who have, you know, developed their area of specialization with the rise of computerization are now retiring, and a number of their studies have been closed, but they have ongoing value and ongoing use. And then a number of the studies have stipulations that the data must be maintained and publicly available for ongoing use. We're dealing right now with several clinical studies that have been funded by the National Eye Institute, which require public access, of course, with privacy of identifiers. A number of individuals, faculty members at our institution in health informatics and also in biostatistics have been very interested in developing a program in public health informatics in which valuable data could, throughout the institution, health-related data could be centralized and made accessible for ongoing public health studies. And they worked on this project for 2 years, and it was not funded because the cost of actually setting it up and maintaining it was far more than the executives and the CFOs felt could be viable. I mean, it's something that possibly now with some of the stimulus funding, some funds could be made available. But these are some of the things that are happening, and it's kind of exciting that finally there is this degree of interest for the preservation and ongoing use of data. Of course, there's interest in just having the data for modeling purposes, also ongoing teaching, and then finally, documentation of the research processes. My colleague Phoebe, who is here today, and I have been trying to really work out some of the new factors that must go into the appraisal of research data. And one of the things we've come to terms with very early on, that the appraisal is not something that just an archivist can do, or even a team of archivists. It requires archivists reaching out to many experts, not only beginning with, if possible, the investigator who designed the study and generated the data, but we also have to work closely with legal and compliance to understand the implications of what needs to be saved and for how long. And then, first of all, as archivists, we try to assess the significance of the content. What is the intrinsic value of it? And we do need a body of experts to help us determine that, because, for instance, in molecular biology, actually only molecular biologists understand the content of the data. And then the next thing is the quality of the content, the quality of the data. And once again, we have to turn to experts to help determine that. Not only IT people, but statisticians and subject experts in the topics. And then the viability for use. How can it be made accessible, retrievable, and used in analysis? And this is sometimes the most enormous cost factor. And then finally, the feasibility for preservation, which includes factors for storage, maintenance, and then ability to migrate the content. And then, of course, the bottom line of doing all this, the affordability. And so we find that there really we're having to undertake cost benefit of, you know, whether it's even viable for the institution to try to preserve this. And we are just in the beginning stages of trying to work on these kinds of retention schedules, and we'll be working more in the fall. We have nothing really to show you yet, just some thoughts about what we're going to do. And so the objectives of this session really are to try to generate interest and raise awareness in some of these issues, because the more we read and the more we talk to colleagues, we realize that, you know, there are few archivists who really have experience in this. And I think that the only way we can go forward is, you know, having a segment of the archival community, such as those of us who are in science, technology, and healthcare, to work together as we move forward, and to, you know, promote dialogue, and you know, as we see our way to the future, that it's going, in order to do anything, archivists are going to have to collaborate more with, you know, outside professionals as we deal with this. And then I hope that in our discussion and also the afterlife of the session, that we'll have, you know, some new ideas to consider, and, you know, possibly I would hope another group might consider doing a panel session or a program next year. So at this point, I want to introduce our distinguished panel. I've chosen, since they all have accomplished so much, I've chosen from their resumes to select their specializations that really, and contributions that really apply most to this session, to, once again, to save time. And first of all, I want to introduce Jeremy Norman. He will be our first speaker. And as we, my colleagues at Hopkins and I, have turned toward trying to understand, you know, how to appraise and select research data, Jeremy has become a real hero, because he is really the pioneer in collecting experimental research data, namely that of molecular biology. And he has, I think, in some ways helped legitimize the collection of that data. And sometimes archivists do need to point to collectors, especially in dealing with our administrators, and saying, you know, well, this is a highly collectible. That helps support our arguments for the intellectual, overall intellectual value of the material. And I must say that over the past 6 months or so, in every conversation with Jeremy that I've had, I've learned so much. Jeremy is president of Jeremy Norman and Company, Inc. He has a rare books and manuscript business that specializes in the history of science and also medicine. And his specialized work and appraisal and collecting in the history of molecular biology has been of very particular interest and help as we have been proceeding with our considerations for appraisal. Next is Shannon Bola, who is librarian and archivist, and has one of the reasons we were so interested in having her speak today is that when she was an archivist at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory on Long Island, she processed and cataloged the laboratory notebooks of James B. Watson, and is one archivist who's had significant firsthand experience in actually cataloging laboratory notebooks. And so I think we all have a lot to learn from Shannon. And the other item in her very long and impressive resume that caught my attention, and I would like to pick her brain myself after this session, she collaborated on a collection policy manual for both digital and analog materials in the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory. And I think that is something that would be of interest to a lot of us who are here today. Oops. And finally, Nancy Mele, who is an archivist at NARA in the Electronic and Special Media Records Service Division, and she processes and provides reference, and this is a direct quote, which I thought was so good that I should borrow from her resume. She collects permanently valuable electronic records of the federal government. And in particular, I've been so interested because she is working with digital research data from both NIH and CDC. And just to inform you that neither NIH nor CDC at this point has any real integrated program in place for preserving and managing research data. So that gives you an indication of how much work needs to be done. So what I thought was, after each speaker presents, at the conclusion, then we would hold our questions. And I'm going to cease right now so Jeremy can get started, and look forward to hearing your questions and responses and ideas at the end of this session. Thank you.
Thank you, Nancy. This morning I'm going to talk about collecting and preserving the source materials of scientific research. I am a rare book dealer, a manuscript dealer, a collector, and appraiser. I'm not a professional archivist. I normally handle a lot of individual letters, occasionally a notebook, and from my perspective and my experience, what I'm normally involved with is establishing the historical significance, sometimes the authenticity, and always the fair market value. In order to buy and sell something, you have to be able to establish its value. In order to appraise it, I usually have to work out the historical significance of material, and I'm usually asked to determine the fair market value for tax purposes, insurance purposes, donations, etc. I'd like to talk about four different examples from my experience and give you an idea of how these might apply to the issue of collecting the source materials of scientific research. The first example was from 1990 when I appraised the papers of Paul Ehrlich, the microbiologist, a very interesting situation because Paul Ehrlich had died in 1915, and yet his papers were still in private hands and were being donated to the Rockefeller Archive Center that Darwin Stapleton was running. And I was contacted and asked to evaluate these. The second example I'm going to mention will be my collection in molecular biology that got sold in the year 2005. I'm also going to discuss two manuscript notebooks by Paul Ehrlich that came on the market and which I sold last year, I believe. And more recently, the appraisal of the diploid cell strain, which I think is a first possibly in appraisals, actually the appraisal of living cells that I did with the tax lawyer Bruce Barnett in 2008 for Leonard Hayflick, who had developed this diploid cell line known as W38, and wanted to donate it to the Cornell National Laboratories. And I could also mention that the process of appraising data, digital files, is already starting in that I have been for several years appraising digital files of photographs that are being donated by professional photographers to an institution in the Bay Area. The Paul Ehrlich papers are a great story of survival. Most of them remained in the family home, but Paul Ehrlich had died in 1915. He was a Jewish scientist. He was one of the early winners of the Nobel Prize. He was famous in hematology, immunology, chemotherapy. Everybody's probably heard of the magic bullet and 606. A lot of his papers were apparently still in the family home when the property was seized by the Nazis. And some of his papers had been removed from Germany by Martha Marquardt, his secretary, and taken to Switzerland and came to the Wellcome Institute for the History of Medicine. And Martha Marquardt used those to write a biography of Paul Ehrlich that was published in 1951. Some of them remained in the Pincus family. And after World War II, Paul Ehrlich's grandson actually went to back to Germany, knocked on the door of the family home, and asked if they happened to have anything. And the buyer of the house was there, and he actually said, well, just wait a minute. And so he took Gunter Schwerin out into a shed out on the, in the woods somewhere, and they knocked down a false wall. And behind this, he had walled in all of these manuscripts and notebooks of Paul Ehrlich to preserve them during the war, because since Ehrlich had been Jewish, the Nazis would have destroyed this material. So Gunter Schwerin wound up owning this material, and the Wellcome Institute placed their Paul Ehrlich papers at the Rockefeller Archives Center. The Schwerin apparently offered his papers to several institutions. I didn't know it at the time, but I was asked to set the fair market value, and it was possible to do it partly because of all the archival work that had been done on this by the Rockefeller Archives Center. I mean, Ehrlich's writing is notoriously impossible to read, but they had an archivist there who'd learned to read his handwriting, and so it had been all analyzed, and some of it had even been translated. So I broke it into sections and tried to come up with comparables for a lot of the different portions of this material, and I recently reviewed my appraisal from 1990, and I have to say, as we would, a lot of people would say, that many of the values are incredibly low by modern standards. Things have really gone up, and there were virtually priceless items that, you know, you can't really put a dollar value on, but I had to do it. Now, unbeknownst to me, the purpose of that appraisal was really more than just determining its dollar value. The purpose was that the donor, Gunter Schwerin, had required that the recipient, Rockefeller Archives Center, raise an amount of money equal to the appraised value and use that to endow a fellowship. And so that was accomplished sometime after I did the appraisal. The appraisal material included a lot of laboratory notebooks and research material that Ehrlich had used in his day-to-day research, and from that one could see actually how he ran his laboratory. It included, the core of it was really 23,000 pages of his copy books, which showed on a day-to-day basis essentially like 30 years of research. And he would also hand out cards each day which gave instructions to various people in his laboratory, and he kept copies of those cards along with all kinds of research data. The second example that I'd like to sort of briefly discuss is a collection on molecular biology that I made because material was offered to me in the late 1990s. Included the notebooks of Max Perutz, his correspondence with Lawrence Bragg, basically the administrator of the Cambridge Laboratory and the early winner of the Nobel Prize. Max Perutz got the Nobel Prize for the structure of hemoglobin, which was the first biological molecule to be understood, structure which was understood at the molecular level. I also had Peretz's correspondence with the Nobel Prize winner Dorothy Hodgkin. I had Max Peretz's, all of his notebooks that he'd kept starting in the 1930s on research on hemoglobin. In that was also the papers of Aaron Klug, who was the literary executor of Rosalind Franklin and who had inherited a great deal of her scientific manuscripts. That included scientific notebooks, manuscripts, photographs, and correspondence of Rosalind Franklin. The main other repository came from her family and is on deposit at Churchill College. And there were other things. For example, Aaron Klug had perhaps 200 scientific notebooks. I had basically his work up until about 1980. And other material that really was something that is virtually was unfindable and I felt was something that was worth buying. I bought it as an investment, and it was eventually sold to the Craig Venter Institute, where an appropriate location for it. I mean, this is highly technical material. I also had the desiccation flask of Rosalind Franklin that she used to prepare the DNA samples that were used to make her famous photograph of that showed the helical structure of DNA, and I had her file copy of the photograph, which is often reproduced. The issue really, yes, I've got 5 minutes to go. Okay. Now, I could go on for a very long time, but let me just say that two notebooks of Paul Ehrlich came on the market last year. Was there interest in them? And yes, I mean, one had was about 606, and I mean, these are scientific research notebooks. There was a buyer right away, and people are interested in collecting the source materials of scientific research. Let's see, what else do I want to talk about? I think that as science becomes more and more specialized, there's no question that the most significant work is and material that really needs to be collected the most is actually the practice of science. That is, the letters, manuscripts, and documents that actually record the work of science. And so it is, from the standpoint of collecting, dealing, and appraisal, these kinds of laboratory research books, correspondence between scientists, the artifacts of science, medicine, and technology are the most important material that should be preserved, whether or not it is technical, whether or not you feel that it may only appeal to a very small audience of experts. Science is becoming more and more specialized, and the history of science is also sort of following, and so that the people who will do the research eventually are people that will understand it, and I don't think that you should hesitate to preserve material, no matter how specialized it may be.
Good morning. My talk today is going to be on preserving laboratory notebooks in the health sciences. And I'll begin by reading from a selection from a paper that I've been writing. Recently, Rich Roberts, Sidney Brunner, together wrote a correspondence to Nature, issuing a plea to scientists to save your notes, drafts, and printouts. They argued that science is one of the greatest cultural achievements of humankind, and yet there is little systematic preservation of the workings of scientists. They particularly cite the importance of materials documenting the development of molecular biology as a field. Since the discovery of the double helix in 1953, biological research has flourished at an ever-increasing pace, and many basic insights continue to emerge. Our knowledge of the workings of organisms from all branches of life is increasing at an unprecedented rate, making it imperative that we document the history of these discoveries. Laboratory notebooks document the day-to-day activities of a scientist. They also complement results in journals and patents by demonstrating how experiments were done in detail, tracing each step and thought leading to a discovery. The public display of laboratory notebooks, then, holds the potential to profoundly influence the future of science education and research by advancing discussion and the sharing of ideas among scientists through what has been called open notebooks science. Online laboratory notebooks hold the potential to promote a general interest in the field of science, provide real-world examples to supplement students' textbook studies, and possibly facilitate the patenting process. When scientists learn to value their laboratory notebooks as items of enduring value, both to the scientific and historical communities, they might be more encouraged to engage in this form of collaborative communication in the 21st century. This talk, then, is an attempt to address the concerns in this article and to raise awareness among archivists about the need to preserve and make publicly available an ever-increasing number of documents created by medical researchers and scientists which can be digitized or are increasingly born digital, such as electronic laboratory notebooks. Accessing data and information in hard copy notebooks, I'm going to talk a little bit about my experience working with the Watson Collection at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, in which we processed the original laboratory notebooks of Dr. Watson and then prepared those items for digitization and implementation into our digital content management system. So the items are actually digitized now and available on the internet for any researcher to consult. As the archivist of the James D. Watson Collection at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, I worked with the papers of James D. Watson and his laboratory notebooks in particular. As such, I helped preserve the hard copy notebooks and make them accessible to researchers. The analog notebooks themselves are valuable to writers and historians who help bring stories describing scientific life to light and provides details to a science researcher that lie just beyond memory's grasp or they detail more than what is published in journal results. For example, when Dr. Watson published his best-selling book, The Double Helix, in 1968, just 6 years following the Nobel Prize and 15 years following the discovery of the structure of DNA, Watson begins his story when he travels to the University of Cambridge. But it was 38 years later, and more than half a century after solving the DNA structure, that he returned to his notebooks when he wrote Avoid Boring People, in which he consulted his laboratory notebooks, which were in the archives, and without which memory may have not provided enough detail to be able to competently recall something that he did when he was in his 20s. So the laboratory notebooks provided a level of detail as well as an opportunity for him to rethink and reconsider the research that he did at an earlier age, given the knowledge of molecular biology that we have today, and may have come to some different conclusions than he had when he first did the research. At Bloomington, that's where Watson did his original research as a student, during his undergraduate years, he was interested in studying ornithology. It was a hobby he had pursued with his father while he was growing up. And it's an interesting story that he had read Schrodinger's What is Life? And that book convinced him, along with a number of physicists, to enter what became the field of molecular biology. Many physicists were brought into the scene, like Crick, for example, because they thought that there would be a new branch of physics that would be emerging, which was not exactly the case. But at that time, while he was at Bloomington and beginning his research studies, he was already contemplating how, in the presence of Delbruck, he had hoped he might someday participate in just some little great revelation which would unravel one of nature's biggest secrets. So he had already set for himself an agenda with great ambitions. Before 1950, there had only been three models shown to interfere with the absorption and killing of host bacterium by a bacteriophage. Schlesinger determined that heat kill bacteria, which were unable to reproduce, can absorb a limited amount of active bacteriophages, making them inactive. So Luria and Delbruck found that ultraviolet radiation particularly damages bacteriophages so that they become unable to reproduce and therefore inactivated. So the basis for his dissertation research was whether phages inactivated by X-rays would give any multiplicity reaction, which was in fact an agenda set by his dissertation advisor, and which he encountered a number of difficulties and eventually felt that he was on the wrong track. After completing his dissertation in 1950, he traveled to Copenhagen tracking the phages with which ended up becoming known as recombinant DNA, what we know today as recombinant DNA. With the completion of the phage course at Cold Spring Harbor and his dissertation, it made sense that Watson would follow up by studying the behavior of viruses as transportation mechanisms. Since neither of the chemical structure of DNA or RNA had been figured out at the time, Watson began his study at Copenhagen by labeling viral DNA and RNA with radioactive isotopes to track the transfer of genetic material. Later, after receiving his PhD, Watson said he headed to Herman Klacker's laboratory in Copenhagen because Klacker had taken the finest phage course at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory taught by Delbruck in 1946 and afterwards expressed an interest in phage multiplication. Klacker, a biochemist, was investigating nucleotide chemistry, specifically the synthesis of small molecules that make up DNA. And Watson believed that working in his laboratory might be an opportunity to study the chemical structure of the nucleotides present in DNA. But after arriving in Copenhagen, Watson soon figured out that Klacker had changed his research agenda to nucleoside rearrangements. In 1951, Ole Moloe, a Danish scientist, made informal arrangements to oversee the continuation of Watson's phage replication experiments. And here's where the laboratory notebooks come into effect. There's some very complex and little narrated laboratory notebooks data, so that it was very difficult to figure out what exactly was going on in some of these experiments. So what we were able to piece together, Watson was using radioactive isotopes of phosphorus, P32, and carbon, C14, to label the specific genetic material transferred from parental to progeny phages. When Linus Pauling announced his alpha helix structure, Moloe indicated that he wanted to leave for Pauling's lab at Caltech the next year. But Watson decided that his best recourse was to solicit Luria to obtain a position in Kendrew's laboratory. So the laboratory notebooks at both Bloomington and Copenhagen are part of the laboratory notebooks collection, and going through and organizing and rearranging and describing in the finding aid some of the processes involved, and actually involved a consultation with Dr. Watson, consulting previously published materials relating to the research, published journal articles. So it was a piecing together of the materials that were available to be able to document what exactly was happening in the laboratory notebooks to make them more interesting to researchers when preparing a finding aid. And as a previous speaker noted, it's frequently an area reserved for specialists. What is the value of laboratory notebooks to research writers and historians? While performing his pre-Nobel laboratory research, James Watson may not have learned anything from his labors, except that his dissertation supervisor, Salvador Luria, was on the wrong track. He needed not to look at reactivation, but biochemical structure to learn more about the structure of DNA and its function. Watson requested his own laboratory notebooks to refresh his memory when writing his latest book. After reviewing the notebooks, he added new details that were not present in previous publications. If the notebooks had not been preserved, he might not have been able to reconstruct and describe experiments. Without his explanations in the book, it may have been difficult, if not impossible, for a historian to accurately piece together the facts to ascertain the purpose, nature, and results that were driving Watson's scientific process and his thinking. What we can learn by examining the details presented in the notebooks today is that Watson's virus research was among the first to explore viruses as transportation mechanisms and to study their functions in detail. His laboratory notebooks document control damage to DNA using X-rays. They also document his observations and controlled experiments, which turned out to be later on the timeline, DNA synthesis, naturally occurring genetic recombination, and the production of progeny with recombinant DNA. Today, technology based on this type of research is being used to harness viruses to deliver targeted therapies for research in the biomedical and cancer research fields. When even the memory of the health science researcher can be questionable, as well as their inability to assess the significance of the research at the time that it was conducted, it is understandable why companies would want to retain laboratory notebooks for potential patenting purposes, and how historians can also use a combination of materials, including laboratory notebooks, research commentaries, etc., to piece together the history of science. In terms of what we as archivists can do, there's several models that we could consult if we were to decide to put together a centralized repository for laboratory notebooks of scientists. And I actually talked a little bit about this previously at Oxford during a previous talk. And some of the models that present themselves could be the Library of Congress's depository method, where scientists and researchers could have a centralized depository, something that's secure, something that is accessible, something that could be redacted if necessary before depositing those materials for patenting reasons. Some companies are reluctant to deposit materials because of the potential for patents that have not yet emerged. So a couple other examples, Project Gutenberg, what Project Gutenberg did for the humanities, making a lot of these in the public domain is particularly. We could possibly do something like that for the sciences. Google Scholar and Google Print, as you know, Google has a profound market effect in terms of their ability to gather and organize and distribute information generally. So we could follow possibly a Google model. There's the patent office. Probably the patent office would be one of the closest models that we could look at in terms of how we might organize data, because the two would go together well in terms of the fact that laboratory notebooks are often used in patent dispute cases. So, when speaking with someone who is a scientist and put together the protein structure initiative, it's one of the first examples of taking that I've seen of taking laboratory notebooks and migrating that data directly into a database and making it available. The individual I talked to was Dr. Bingham at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And he said the major obstacle in terms of getting scientists to contribute their notebooks is the fact that they had to make compliance mandatory. So scientists are reluctant to turn over their notebooks. From a variety of sources, including published journal articles, histories, and a consultation with Dr. Watson, I was able to piece together a bit of history that describes the contextual background of laboratory notebooks when I was writing a finding aid for this series. Not all laboratory notebooks will have the luxury of a book published describing a firsthand account of a scientist's process and reasoning through the research process like Watson's. So it's increasingly important to try to link together these materials and with the scientific equipment used to produce these experiments, the correspondence of the scientists describing their thinking and the scientific method that they're employing, the correspondence with individuals describing other research going on, competing ideologies, competing methodologies. So without a centralized location for laboratory notebooks, there's a definite lack of communication among scientists, among historians, for gathering this valuable historical research data and making it available to the public. Thank you.
Good morning. I am primarily a reference archivist, so while I will talk about appraisal and access, I'm probably going to be spending most of my time talking about some of the surveys and studies that we have in our custody. All right, so the first question is, why does the National Archives have health research data? It all starts with, as you might expect, the Federal Records Act. I'm not going to read the whole thing, I promise, just the pertinent parts. Which defines records as all machine-readable materials or other documentation materials, regardless of physical form or characteristics, made or received by an agency, as evidence of the organization, operations, or other activities of the government because of the informational value of the data. It goes on to require all executive branch agencies to schedule their records. Since the data are evidence of the operations and have informational value of the National Institutes of the National Institutes of Health and the Center for Disease Control, and since both of those agencies are executive branch agencies, NARA has health research data. So how do we get the records? An agency proposes a schedule defining the temporary or permanence, the temporality of the records, which is reviewed by NARA's appraisal unit. There are specific factors in NARA's appraisal handbook for scientific data. The first one is who has primary responsibility for the data. If the agency who is proposing the schedule does not have primary responsibility, it is for that agency temporary. It may be permanent for another agency if the second agency has primary responsibility. And this gets important for health research because it's often done collaboratively with not just agencies, but with private institutions, medical centers, and all sorts of other people get involved. The second primary appraisal piece is the duplicability and future usefulness of the data. If the data will be extremely difficult or impossible to replicate and are potentially useful for such purposes as permitting an important experiment to be reviewed and validated, supporting new scientific research, or providing a legal basis for health-related claims, then the value as possible permanent records goes up. Once the determination has been made that the data is permanent and it's been transferred to the National Archives, my unit, the Electronic and Special Media Record Services Division, which has custodial responsibility for electronic records in the National Archives, data in particular verifies the data to make sure that it is what it's supposed to be and that we have all necessary documentation to make it available for future researchers. The unit's first accession in 1970 is called Tektite 1, 1,440 hours under the sea. It came from NASA, and it includes medical data. Amongst what was collected during this study, this experiment, was data on the general health quality as well as descriptions of any, quote, medically interesting or important occurrences and treatment of the four aquanauts who participated in the experiment. However, the majority of our data is from NIH and CDC. And while there is some clinical research data, the majority of it tends to be epidemiological in nature. What follows is some highlights of what is in our custody. These were picked to show the diversity of the collection and do not reflect the entirety of the health data that we have in our holdings. I've conveniently made a handout. They're available over there. This lists all of the series that I'm going to talk about this morning, as well as everything we have from NIH and CDC. From among the series that we have at NIH is the National Collaborative Perinatal Project. It is a perennial favorite amongst researchers. It's actually a very good example of the criteria for duplicability for permanent retention. This study involved collecting data on approximately 58,000 pregnancies in 12 cities involving 24 institutions over a 15-year period. Replicating this study would be nearly impossible. It was undertaken to enable biomedical and behavioral researchers to discover leads to the developmental disorders of childhood to subsequent developmental disorders. By relating events of pregnancy, labor, delivery, infancy, and early childhood to subsequent development of the child. The major categories of data collected included obstetrical, pediatric, pathological, seriological, socioeconomic and family, genetic history, psychological, speech, language, and hearing. The mother was examined during pregnancy, labor, and delivery. The children were given neonatal examinations and follow-up examinations at 4, 8, and 12 months, as well as at 3, 4, 7, and 8 years. In addition to all of this, supplemental information was gathered throughout the study, including family linkages between related women participating in the study. The epidemiological studies of occupational groups was also done by NIH, and it was conducted to determine factors or substances in work environments that may have caused cancer, ways in which these factors or substances may have caused cancer, and the characteristics of persons who may have been particularly susceptible to the environmental factors, substances, and or cancers. Among the groups that were studied were veterans, ceramic workers, and acrylonitrile workers. And I can never remember what acrylonitrile is. I apologize. I think it's some sort of plastic polymer. So from among the data that we have at the CDC, we have something called the Behavioral Risk Surveillance Survey, which was used for the collection of uniform, state-specific data on preventative health practices and risk behaviors that linked chronic diseases. I think that's supposed to be that we're linked to chronic diseases, injuries, and preventable infectious diseases. Federal and health state departments have used this data to identify demographic variations in health-related behaviors, target services, address emergent and critical health issues, propose legislation for health initiatives, and measure progress toward achieving state and national health objectives. We also have from CDC the longitudinal study on aging, which offers an example of the collaborative research and determining primary responsibility. The CDC collaborated with the National Institute on Aging to create the study, but it is accessioned as a CDC series, not as an NIH series. And they did so in order to measure changes in functioning and living arrangements of a group of older Americans. The study was undertaken for several reasons: to collect data on the oldest old, to describe the life course continuum from functionally independent living through dependence, including institutionalization, to death, to measure changes in the functional status and living arrangements of older Americans, and to provide mortality rates that were unavailable from the vital statistics systems, and to obtain measures of healthcare use over time. Okay, some comments on preservation, reference, and access. In general, the four series that I just talked about, like most of the data, and specifically data in our custody, these are preserved in hardware and software independent formats so that any researcher from any institution can take the data and put it into their preferred study software. And they are accompanied generally in the early years by paper documentation, which will include record layouts and code lists, along with some background material. Documentation is increasingly received in electronic formats, generally either as plain text or PDF files. Plain text we consider to be a hardware and software independent format. PDF is not, but we do have guidelines for transfer and preservation of PDF, and we also keep original bit streams so that if things change, we can change with them. The National Archives provides access to this data, as well as most of our data, by making copies onto removable media for a cost recovery charge. This may be changing. We expect it to change under ERA. I'll get to that a little later. This is important, though. Most health data comes with a warning to the users that prohibits the matching of data from multiple studies to deductively discover the personal identity and information of participants. It is how we are able to make this data available. There are no personal names, but there is much personal information about the participants. And this is how the scientific research community in the federal government and the federal government has agreed to make these available, is with this warning. In general, the users of our health study data are researchers looking for historical data against which to compare new data, or who wish to examine the older data from a new angle. And increasingly, what they really are looking for is full file downloads. They want the data now. They don't want to wait 2 to 3 weeks to get it. And, you know, I don't really blame them. 2 to 3 weeks can seem like a really long time if you're really excited about something. So when the transition to the Electronic Records Archives is complete, we do expect that we will be able to provide direct download of full files for any data that is not subject to FOIA or otherwise restricted. This means, however, that at some point we are going to have to digitize all of the analog data in our custody. Two final points. All of the data in the National Archives is in the public domain, which means researchers can do whatever they want with it. In fact, the National Bureau of Economic Research has put the entirety of the National Perinatal Project on its website. You can download from them all of the documentation and all of the data. And I'm being told I have run out of time, so I will stop right there. Thank you.
I want to thank the three panelists for excellent presentations and now open up the floor to any questions. Lee?
Just two questions. One, social science data archives of ICPSR at the University of Michigan have been taking researcher survey data for more than 30 years and making it available. And I wonder if this might hold some model possibilities also for scientific data, although the social science researchers seem to be more willing to let their data go than any hard scientists are. And also, HERPARIS 2, one of its components was to look at the preservation of scientific data. I wonder if any of the speakers have looked at those results and factored that in.
Yes.
Okay, I'll take that one, I guess. The question was, has anyone looked at some of the inter pares models in terms of the preservation? Yes, I have. In fact, I'm very familiar with one of the studies, the NASA materials that were preserved, the digital materials. As far as their application to, for example, laboratory notebooks, the primary evaluation tool that I think needs to be considered after talking to patent attorneys, after talking to scientists, after talking to historians, is the fact that it needs to have security to it. It should not just be, it can't be hacked into where materials can be taken from it. Okay, so it's going to have to be a secure database. It's also going to have some serious confidentiality issues to it, and what can be redacted and what can't, and who's going to review these materials for the redaction. So I don't know if any of those things are addressed in any of the other studies. I know that the basic inter pares model was how to actually physically transfer it, how to look at the metadata structure involved to ensure the authenticity of the documents. So those things, while those things are important, particularly in digital migration of data, crossing lines from one repository to another, but the patent database, all of the materials now are submitted online. Copyright is now all done online. These are considered secure methods of deposit, and the depositories themselves are considered secure. So some of the models that I talked about before are good in terms of essentially collecting and making the materials available, but they're not secure. Okay, so that's why I suggested maybe the patent database and as a more reliable type of model. But one of the things that it's not considering is the patent database is simply a depository of materials, and it's not necessarily educational in and of itself. So as an archivist or as a historian, you're going to want to have links, perhaps, to the types of equipment, the links out to the descriptions of how the equipment operated, the dates of use, maybe some description of the processes involved and who created those processes. And with that information, it can become more of an educational tool than simply having the depository of the information available in and of itself. And the last one, the example I gave, the fellow from Wisconsin, I believe, Madison, the project that they were working on, it was not just a depository of data. They combined it into a website that was actually an educational tool. So it can be used to retrieve data, and you can do searches for specific proteins, for example. But it's also educational in nature, and there's descriptive materials about the processes. And in talking with him through chat, he detailed many of the technicalities involved in the transfer of documents. And it was a fairly complicated process, which he described. And some of that information is available on their website. But it was the first real example. And from their website, you couldn't really tell if they were laboratory notebooks, so I just asked him outright, are there laboratory notebooks that are being migrated into this system? And he said, yes, absolutely. So from my perspective for the talk, that's perhaps a very good model to look at also. I don't think the Enterprise 3, I think, is coming out now. There's someone speaking on that at this conference, and I would suggest that if you're attending that or have attended that, you maybe speak with one of the people on that project. Luciana Durante is the head of that, and she may be able to answer your question in more detail in terms of serving as a model for depository. An ERA project, I had asked you about that a little bit yesterday, and as far as we know so far, hasn't been any significant structure put in place specifically for something like a laboratory notebook. So,
also, you might want to know CENSA, which is the Coalition, I think, for Electronic Scientific Notebook Association, was a participant in Inter Pares projects from the beginning.
I'd be interested in getting the name of that person, a contact person for that.
Sure.
Okay, there was somebody here. Yes?
Citation to the Nature article, please.
Yeah, why don't I email it to you? Can you?
Okay, and Bingham's first name is?
Craig. A. Craig A. Bingham.
Craig. This was a project.
No, the project is called the Protein Structure Initiative Knowledge-Based Protein Model Portal. It's the full name of it. And Dr. Craig A. Bingman, B-I-N-G-M-A-N, at the University of Wisconsin-Madison is on the organizing team and, in fact, is a major person on this project. So.
Any other? Yes.
I would say that mixing the material types is okay as long as they don't meet any special preservation needs. For example, we had some X-ray films, okay, that needed to be kept separate because they were nitrate materials and highly flammable. So we didn't want to necessarily keep them mixed in with the regular collection, so we'd simply put in a marker in the collection indicating that in this section, following along with the finding aid in the structure, that there was an item that is kept separately and where it's at. And so if a researcher requested that material. But a lot of the items that were non-print, I mean, it's difficult. How do you digitize something like that? You take a photograph of it and then put the photograph on your website. In terms of that, yes, there were materials that were non-print materials that needed to be dealt with in the collection. Does that answer your question? Okay.
I'd like to pick up on Lee's comment about our race, but with a different perspective. So it seems to me that there may be at least two groups here, those who are interested in the history of science, which I think I'm hearing largely from that panel. But there's also another group, people who do secondary data analysis. They want to look at the data. They're not as interested in the history of science and development theories there, et cetera. But what I want to say with regard to the issue of digital preservation is that I've worked in two pharmaceutical companies, and I've done extensive work for patent and trademark office. And one of the emerging trends for the submission of clinical trial data, as well as submission of patents, especially those that are complex work units that deal with protein data bank issues and things like that, is the reliance upon a technology neutral format. XML is the one that's emerging, which addresses a number of long-term, long-term could be 100 years, but it does address the secondary issue. The real problem is not in the clinical data or the patent applications, but in the laboratory analysis, where the tools used to measure, test some of the algorithms are being replaced, and it will be very, very difficult to replicate the current technology, current algorithms that are supported with laboratory analysis that was conducted 10 or 15 years ago. There's no easy solution to that. But with regard to clinical trial data, I think there's a very real possibility
of being able to question
mitigate some of the digital preservation issues.
Thank you. Well, I think Arian's been holding people off, so we should relieve him. And please, follow up with any of your comments or questions.